Hello. Hope you're having a nice Sabbath. It's beautiful out there, but it's a little deceivingly cold, I think. But it's a good reminder that the fall holy days will be here soon. For today's message, I'll actually be spending our time considering some end-time events and their connection to the upcoming holy days and the fall feasts. Because as we spend the time coming up talking about the Feast of Trumpets and the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles on the eighth day, I think it's good to sometimes take a step back as we come to those days and think about what's going on in prophetical times to what leads up to these events when they do actually come and be fulfilled. Now, as with any prophecy, I feel like I have to give a warning. That we have to realize that we don't have every detail and we don't have, you know, perfect understanding of prophecy. And so as we talk today, I'm going to try to stay big picture and just kind of keep a general outline of what leads up to what these holy days picture and symbolize for each one of us. And I don't pretend to know all about prophecy and know the exact when and how everything's going to take place. No, but I did think about in the Bible, do you know who is the smartest guy in the Bible? The guy who has all the answers. Abraham, because he knew a lot. Wendy's shaking her head. She doesn't like when I tell jokes. But anyway, as we consider this prophecy today, I wanted to be clear that I'm not pretending like we have perfect understanding or know every detail, but it's important for us to consider these things nonetheless and think about how they lead up to these fall holidays that are coming and what they picture for us and for the rest of mankind as well. So as a general backstory then, if we just think about the book of Revelation itself, you know, we'll begin with an overview. Revelation's main prophetic messages are unveiled primarily through seven seals, or seven sets of seals, on a scroll that are fastened with these seven seals. Jesus Christ, we're told, is the one that comes and breaks these seals, and he opens them before John's eyes, the writer of the book of Revelation. And John sees and describes the symbols of these visions, of these things that are going to take place as these end-time events happen and are fulfilled. And we're told him back in Revelation 5 that Christ alone has the right to open these seals, to unveil the meaning of these seals. But it's interesting that even before he does this in Revelation 5, he actually explained a lot of the same things back when he was alive on the earth before his death and resurrection. Now, if we actually went to Matthew 24, Mark 13, or Luke 21, that as Jesus gives what often his sermons at the end time of prophetic events, he actually outlines these same things that we'll read today. And so today, why don't we actually go and begin there in Matthew chapter 24. As we consider these end time events in Revelation, we'll actually spend the beginning of this flipping between Matthew 24 and Revelation 6. Because notice what we read in Matthew 24 in verse 3. Because as I said, Jesus Christ, when he was alive, actually outlined a lot of these same things that we'll read about in Revelation in a few minutes. Because in verse 3, it says, "Now as he sat on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, 'Tell us, when will these things be? And what will be the sign of your coming and the end of the age?'" So as most of mankind has done, who've studied the Bible, they've always wondered, you know, when is this going to happen? When is the end going to come? When is Jesus Christ going to return? And his disciples asked him the same question here. And notice what Jesus Christ responds. It says, "And Jesus answered and said to them, 'Take heed that no one deceives you. For many will come in my name, saying, I am the Christ, and will deceive many.'" So he says there will be deception. He says, "When you hear of wars and rumors of wars, see that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." So he says there's this religious deception, there's going to be wars, but that's not quite the end. And he continues, "For nation will rise against a nation, and kingdom against kingdom. And there will be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in various places. And all these are the beginning of sorrows." And then he continues in verse 9, he says, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you'll be hated by all nations for my name's sake." And so he continues, we won't read all this right now, but we'll come back to some of this. Jesus Christ, as they asked, what's going to be the sign of, of your return, of the end of the age. He lays out these things that will take place, of wars, of religious deception, of persecution of his followers. And he lists all these things, and it sounds like quite a terrible time. And as we then go to Revelation 6 in a minute, we'll see that these things actually parallel one another, that the exact list that Jesus Christ gives is the same list we read through Revelation 6. That Jesus was revealing the trends and conditions that would dominate the world until his coming. That as we go to the seals in Revelation 6, they symbolically portray those same conditions that we'll see that Christ outlined here as well. And most of Revelation, probably about two-thirds of it, are really focused on the seventh seal, which contains the seven last trumpets, and that seventh trumpet contains the return of Jesus Christ and the kingdom of God and the seven last plagues. And so most of Revelation is really devoted to that seventh seal and all those things that are take place at that. And that's what's pictured at the Feast of Trumpets and Atonement and the kingdom, or the Feast of Tabernacles on the eighth day. But sometimes we forget that there are some things before that as well, and that's really what I want to focus on today. Those first six seals specifically, and what they picture and represent, and how they can tie into these holy days as well. Because the first five seals really correspond to adversities that are going to afflict vast portions of humanity, including God's people as well. Now between the first and second appearing of Jesus Christ, there's going to be certain things that key in to tell us that the end is getting close. And these hardships began at the time of John as he was writing these things down, as we'll see in a bit. But they extend all the way to the end time as well, and they seem to become stronger and stronger in intensity as we get closer. We actually see this in Matthew 24 and verse 8, if we go back there for a minute. Because as Jesus Christ described these things, once again in verse 7 he said, "For nation will rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there will be famines, pestilence, an earthquake in various places." So he's listing these difficult things that will take place. And then verse 8 he says, "And these are the beginning of sorrows." It's interesting, that word sorrows really can mean calamities. Other translations sometimes even say like labor pains. And if you look up the Greek word for this, it really is connected to this idea of labor pains or birth pains. And if we think about that in context of what that signifies, is that just like as a woman goes through labor, things intensify and get stronger and stronger. I know with us, with our first one, or at least with Ellie, as we went through the process, you know, the first time a woman has a baby, they often think that they're a little closer to having the baby than they are at first. And they go to the doctor, and the doctor says, "Oh no, it's gonna get worse, don't worry." And they oftentimes get sent home, then they come back, and they go through this process at times. And so it's kind of a lesson in that sometimes there's been false alarms that, well, we think things are bad now, but God warns us that just be ready because things are really going to intensify as we get closer and closer. As just like labor pains and those things that take place. And so we're told that these things did begin at the time of John as he wrote a lot of these things down, and even before that with Jesus Christ. But they become to get stronger and intensify as we get closer and closer to the end of the age. And again, we should remember that the primary time frame of Revelation's main prophecies is the day of the Lord. And I'll come back to that a little bit closer to the end. But the day of the Lord is connected to the tribulation, but also is somewhat of a separate event that takes place as well. And we'll see how they overlap and work together as we move on today. But a lot of, again, that seventh seal is all contained within what we often refer to as the day of the Lord. But these first six seals preclude that. They take place before the day of the Lord actually takes place and begins. And so under these six seals, we'll see displayed these amazing signs and wonders that God is going to allow to take place, and things that will transpire just before the day of the Lord, especially as we get to that sixth seal that really separates the tribulation and leads that right into that day of the Lord, as we've talked about in a minute. So with that kind of background and an introduction to Revelation and end time events, let's go ahead and begin. If we go to Revelation chapter 6, if you're Matthew 24, you might want to leave a marker there, because as I said, we'll flip back and forth a little bit in the beginning as we see how these two kind of lead together and work together to just show not only how unified the Bible is, but also that Jesus Christ was describing these same things that took place. So in Revelation 20, or Matthew 24, and in Revelation 6, we'll see as we tie these two together today. Because in Revelation 6, in verse 1 and 2, it begins, "Now I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard one of the four living creatures saying with a loud voice like thunder, 'Come and see.' And I looked, and behold, a white horse. He who sat on it had a bow, and a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer." And as we consider this, oftentimes this explanation of this first horseman looks very similar to something we read later in Revelation as well. And many people read this and think, you know, this seems to indicate Jesus Christ. But actually, what's interesting is that it seems to be a false Jesus Christ. A symbolism of what Jesus Christ represents, but just slightly different. If we think of how Satan often works, he doesn't portray things that look ridiculous, but oftentimes he makes things look just true enough that they can be deceiving, and then he throws in the false and the lies with the half-truths. And we see the same thing here in Revelation 6. We're told about this rider who comes on a white horse. You know, Jesus Christ is often portrayed as coming. He comes back on a white horse as well. And this man is given a crown, or this rider is given a crown. And he's also given a bow to conquer. But notice, if we actually go to Revelation 19 and read about Jesus Christ coming, we'll see that it is similar, but also quite different. Revelation 19 and verse 11. Because here we read about the true coming of Jesus Christ. It says in Revelation 19:11, "Now I saw heaven open, and behold, a white horse." So again, we see a white horse. "And he who sat on him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war." So this clearly is talking about a man of righteousness. Here talking about Jesus Christ. And it also says that he comes to make war as well. But it says, "His eyes were like a flame of fire, and on his head were many crowns. He had a name written that no one knew except himself." So not only do we see that he came in with true and righteousness, but he also came with many crowns. If we go back to Revelation 6, it says that was given only one crown. Symbolic of a much smaller dominion that he was given as he was conquering, but Jesus Christ comes with many crowns because he is the King of Kings. And as we continue, he's also, you know, talked about as coming with that sharp two-edged sword, opposed to the bow that we read about in Revelation chapter 6. And so as we open this first seal, then it ties into this idea of false religion and false Christs that are going to be coming at the end times. Again, if we go back to Matthew 24, the first thing Jesus Christ tells them in verse 4 is that, "Take heed that no one deceives you, for many will come in my name saying, 'I am the Christ,' and will deceive many." And so these two things appear to be very connected. This idea of a false Christ coming, this horseman who comes on a white horse with a crown, seems to be symbolic of someone representing Jesus Christ, but who isn't Jesus Christ. False religion that's going to prevail. Now, if we thought about the early Testament church, these things began all the way back then, and they will continue all the way to the end time when Jesus Christ returns and put an end to it. But again, we remember that these things will magnify and intensify as we get closer and closer to the end as well. And so this first seal is about false religion and deception about true Christianity and who Jesus Christ is. We also see this over in 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8. If we want to turn there as well. 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8. Really, the whole chapter of 2 Thessalonians is really focused on this great deception that's going to take place at the end time. Notice what we read in 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 8. He kind of explains about this counterfeit Christianity that's symbolized in this first seal and that Jesus Christ warned about as well. Because we read in verse 8, "And then the lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will consume with the breath of his mouth and destroy with the brightness of his coming. The coming of the lawless one is according to the working of Satan, with all power, signs, and lying wonders, and with all unrighteous deception among those who perish, because they did not receive the love of the truth, that they may be saved." So here as well, we see in Thessalonians, the Apostle Paul writing a warning about these end time deceptions that will take place. And it doesn't say that someone's just going to come and proclaim to be Jesus Christ, and it'll be easy to tell it's not him. No, but instead we're told he's going to come according to the working of Satan. So he's going to come under the power and influence of Satan and how Satan operates. And he's going to come with power and signs and lying wonders. Again, symbolizing this isn't going to be just someone claiming to be Christ, and obviously it's not. But it says it's going to be someone coming on a horse that looks kind of like what Christ described he's coming on. And he's going to have a crown, just like Christ says he's going to have many crowns. And so we see this connection that there's going to be serious false religion, serious deception going on as we get close. And this first seal is all wrapped up in this false religion that's going to be taking place, that began then and will intensify as we get closer to these things. And that leads on to our second one as well then, the second seal in verse 3. Because then it says, "Now when he opened the second seal, I heard the second living creature saying, 'Come and see.' Another horse, fiery red, went out, and it was granted to the one who sat on it to take peace from the earth, and that people should kill one another, and there is given to him a great sword." And so this horseman obviously is connected to death. As it said, he's given a sword that he should kill one another, and there is given to him a great sword. It's interesting that he's even the color of red, matching blood. And as we go back to Matthew 24, once again, we'll see this connection. Because right after Christ talks about this deception that takes place in verse 5, in verse 6 he says, "And you will hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that you are not troubled, for all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet." So again, we see the second seal Jesus Christ described in that same sequence once again. He says, as there's wars and these things that will take place, like Jesus warned that that's what's going to happen as well, that he is reiterating the same facts that these seals open as well, that as we get close to the end time, there's going to be intensified wars and battles. And we can see that from looking at society around us, whether it's the Middle East or whether it's even Russia and some of the things that go on in those countries, that there's constant wars and rumors of wars, and North Korea and all the things that take place, that there's this constant wonder about what's going on. And there's always the questions about North Korea and what kind of missiles they're building and what they can reach and whether they'd be willing to launch them. And all these questions take place. But Christ says, you know, don't be troubled, because these things have to come to pass before the return of Jesus Christ. It's interesting as well that when Jesus founded the early church, the Roman Empire was experiencing a time of peace at that time. But that peace only lasted a few decades after that, and Rome was again at war. Now this pattern of war continues all the way to the end time, when that last great battle takes place at Jesus Christ's return. Which we won't turn there, but we see in Revelation 19:11, verse 21, when Jesus Christ returns and destroys the armies and establishes the kingdom of God. But even before that final battle, the book of Revelation indicates that there's going to be warfare taking on a global scale. It describes massive armies engaged in military actions that take hundreds of millions of lives. There's going to be catastrophes and wars and these terrible things taking place. So again, one point I want to think about as we consider these seals today is that as Jesus Christ returns and these things take place and the trumpets happen, it can be easy to sometimes wonder why God is going to bring that punishment. But as we think about these seals that are open before this, and we see what mankind is doing to itself, and the destruction and the hatred, that it reminds us that Jesus Christ returns with righteous judgment, that he's coming very justified to take care of the things going on the earth, because this is the state of the world when he returns. And that most of these first five seals seem to be an indication of mankind doing it themselves, that Satan, or that Jesus Christ isn't causing these first destructions, but instead it's Satan's deception and Satan's leadership and mankind's human nature that leads to a lot of these things. And that when Jesus Christ returns and brings the last trumpets, that's when really that Satan, or that Jesus Christ and God, bring their own wrath and punishment on mankind for those actions. And so that's something for us to consider and think about as we open as we look at these first few seals, that it's mostly mankind and Satan's influence that causes these things to take place. That God seems to be removing certain barriers to allow Satan to do more as we get closer to the end time. But that God's punishment of mankind isn't contained within these first seals. It's actually all contained with that seventh seal and those seven last trumpets and those seven last bowls as plagues as well. So then that leads us to the third seal that's going to be opened as well. The third seal says, when he opened it in verse 5 of Revelation chapter 6, when he opened the third seal, I heard the living creature say, come and see. So I looked and behold, a black horse, and he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. I heard the voice in the midst of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius, and three quarts of barley for a denarius, and do not harm the oil and the wine. So we see as this third seal is open, a scarcity of food. It's easy to think that this would happen from the results of the first two seals as well. If we think about the wars that go on and the things that cause that, it's easy to think that all those wars would lead to famine and scarcity of food as well. And so we see in this third seal a scarcity of food that takes place. And if we consider Matthew 24 and verse 7, again, Jesus Christ there says, and there will be famines. So he seems to be indicating and listing the same things as these seals are opened in Matthew 24 as well, once again. And so then we move on to the fourth seal. The fourth seal in Revelation 6 and verse 7 reads, when he opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of a fourth living creature saying, come and see. So I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of him who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed after him. And power was given to them over a fourth of the earth to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and with the beasts of the earth. So as we get to this fourth seal, it describes widespread disease and epidemics and death in the wake of the war and famine in the previous seals. It corresponds once again to Jesus listing in Matthew 24 of the word pestilence. He says there's going to be famines and there's going to be pestilence. This idea that there's going to be deadly epidemics and sicknesses that take place at this time. And we could talk about that those have happened, whether it's the Black Plague and other things that have happened in the past, but it seems to indicate that again, things are going to become intensified and stronger as we get closer and closer to the end. He also mentions that there will be natural disasters and earthquakes, and I think that fits within this concept of plagues as well. Now, if we just look around the U.S. right now, I think it's easy to see that there are lots of natural disasters going on, whether it's the hurricanes down in the Atlantic, again, that seem to be coming one after another right now, or the major fires that are going on in the Northeast that almost are being ignored due to the other things going on. The hurricanes that are hitting Texas and the islands in Florida have kind of taken so much press that they really haven't covered much of how much Montana is being burned and Oregon and Washington and Idaho, that they're the worst fires they said they've had in possibly 100 years, and some of them don't seem that there's any end in sight as well. And so this fourth seal is about you know, increased or mounting tolls of death and disaster that's going to take place. Again, I think we're seeing maybe the beginning of that, but that could be going on for a long time until, again, those labor pains become stronger and stronger, as we're told. That they bring widespread death on scales that we've never seen on the world before. And these elements of war and famine and pestilence and other calamities all probably intensify and reinforce one another as well. But again, as we have wars and famines, that leads to diseases and sicknesses. And the other calamities of earthquakes and things can lead to not having enough food and shelter and those things. And they all probably intensify and build upon one another as well. And these other wars and disasters lead to famines and pestilence and further fighting over the resources that are left. And that as we approach the time when all this is being expanded and really becoming intensified, it's easy to see and realize that mankind's going to be in a pretty rough predicament in a tough situation. More so than we could even understand. Because as we've thought about and studied history of what took place during the Great Depression or World War II or some things that have happened in Russia and other parts of the world, you know, those times have been really intense and really dramatic for groups of people. And we're told over and over that this is going to be like there's never been a time before. So it's a reminder to us that it's going to get very serious and very destructive for lots of people. And at that time in the end, we can expect such dire conditions to impact various nations and the regions of the world, that even God's people will have to suffer through some of these things as well. We'll see in a few minutes as we talk about that God does offer and promise some protection. But it seems like only some of those protections come and not for everyone as well. Because then we move on to the fifth seal. Over in Revelation 6 and verse 9. Revelation 6 and verse 9 we read, "When we opened the fifth seal, I saw under the altar the souls of those who had been slain for the word of God and for the testimony which they held. And they cried out with a loud voice, saying, 'How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?'" So we see this vision of martyrs pleading to God, saying, "When will these things happen? When will you return and avenge the earth for the things that have been going on?" And notice his response. "Then a white robe was given to them, and it was said to them that they should rest a little while longer, until both the number of their fellow servants and their brethren who would be killed as they were was completed." And notice, this says that they are told to rest a little while longer. We know the Bible often equates rest to sleeping and sleeping to death. So this is just a vision of those people who have been killed, the martyrs. And it's God's showing them a vision of saying, instead of thinking that they've been resurrected, as some people try to proclaim, it seems to indicate that they're still sleeping and resting. But instead, God's teaching a lesson through this vision, because he says the number of their fellow servants and their brethren has to be fulfilled or completed. That he's teaching us that through this fifth seal there's going to be martyrdom that takes place. There's going to be martyrs added to this group who have already been killed, who symbolically they're crying out to God. You know, just kind of symbolic of what we're told back in Genesis when it says, you know, Abel's blood cried out to God after he was killed by Cain. That this is just a symbolism of God saying there's going to be more martyrdom to take place, and this fifth seal is about that martyrdom that's going to happen. We can see this again in Matthew 24 and verse 9. If we go back there for a moment. Matthew 24 and verse 9 through 12 we read, "Then they will deliver you up to tribulation and kill you, and you will be hated by all nations for my name's sake. Then many will be offended, will betray one another, and will hate one another. Then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many, and because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will grow cold." So again, we see this parallel between Matthew 24 and these seals as they keep opening. Now the fifth seal is symbolic of martyrdom taking place. And that has happened since the early church. If we think about just the book of Acts, of Stephen being martyred, of the apostle James being martyred early on as well, that there's martyrdoms that took place early in the church. And even back in the Old Testament as well, as prophets were killed and other things happened. And it's happened all the way up to this time. But it's a reminder again that this thing will take place at a stronger level as we get closer to the end. And that's what this vision is about that number being completed before we move on to the next stage of the end time prophecies. So Jesus warned that worse persecution, tribulation, and martyrdom is going to come at the time of the end, as we read right there. We also see if you're still in Matthew 24, turn over to Matthew 24 and verse 21 as well. Because it expands on this a little bit, this idea of how bad conditions are going to get. Because in verse 21 it states, "For then there will be a great tribulation, such as not been since the beginning of the world until this time. No, nor ever shall be. And unless those days were shortened, no flesh would be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days will be shortened." And we're reminded of just how terrible this time is going to be. And that God says he has to intervene just for the sake of mankind. That mankind would annihilate itself if God didn't intervene and prevent these things taking place. So again, as we come to the sixth seal that then leads right into the seventh, we're reminded that mankind's going to be at such a state, at such a place before Jesus Christ intervenes with the seven last trumpets, that it's at a point where it would kill itself if God didn't intervene. And we're told that there's going to be great tribulation and terrible things that have never been done or ever will be done again in similarity. But then that leads right to the sixth seal, which is quite a transition from the first five. Because notice what we read in the sixth seal. Chapter 6 and verse 12 through 14. It says, "I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair. And the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as fig trees drop in the late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it was rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. So here we see awesome and fearful heavenly signs taking place of things falling from the sky, of earthquakes and things shaking and mountains moving. That the previous ones were mostly focused on famines and pestilence and wars. But here we see a very big cosmic disturbance of things changing on a global scale, of things falling from the skies. It's interesting, we'll see that this really is symbolic of the ending of the first six or the first five seals, and kind of leads right into that seventh seal as well. Because if we notice the order of these things, the first five seals are really about the wars and the pestilence once again. The sixth seal kind of is a transition of these heavenly signs, and it leads right to the seventh seal, which introduces the day of the Lord. And again, we see this over in Matthew 24 as well. Matthew 24 and verse 29. Because in Matthew 24, verse 29, as Jesus Christ continues explaining these things that will take place, he states, immediately after the tribulation of those days, so he says, after the tribulation has been going on, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from heaven, and the powers from the heavens will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, and then all the tribes of the earth will mourn, and they will see the Son of Man coming on the clouds of heaven with power and great glory. So we see that these heavenly signs are transitioned from that tribulation that's been taking place to Jesus Christ fulfilling his portion of these things that are about to happen as well. We see this also in Zephaniah 1 and verse 14, if you want to turn with me over there. Zephaniah 1 and verse 14. Okay, back in the Minor Prophets. Zephaniah 1 and verse 14. In Zephaniah 1:14 we read, the great day of the Lord is near. It is near and hastens quickly. The noise of the day of the Lord is bitter. So here Zephaniah is predicting the day of the Lord. He says the day of the Lord is near. And notice how he describes it. He says it's coming quickly. There the mighty men shall cry out. That day is a day of wrath, a day of trouble and distress, a day of devastation and desolation, a day of darkness and gloominess, a day of clouds and thick darkness, a day of trumpet and alarm against the fortified cities and against the high towers. And verse 17 says, I'll bring distress upon men, and they shall walk like blind men because they have sinned against the Lord. Their blood shall be poured out like dust, and their flesh like refuse. And so leading up to this sixth seal hasn't involved the day of the Lord. But as we move from the sixth seal and get into the seventh, then the day of the Lord is fulfilled. If we go back to Revelation one more time in Revelation 6, we see how it explains this as well. Because there in Zephaniah, it's talking about what comes to place after these heavenly signs happen. Revelation 6, once again, if we go to verses 15 through 17, we'll see the rest of the sixth seal and what it states. So right before that, we talked about, you know, the heavenly signs of the things falling and the earth shaking and the mountains moving. In verse 15, we read, and the kings of the earth, the great men, the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and every free man hid themselves in the caves and in the rocks of the mountains. And said to the mountains and rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath is come, and who is able to stand? And so it indicates then that this sixth seal, as it opens, is introducing the wrath of Jesus Christ, the wrath of the Lamb, and is transitioning from the first five seals, which is a tribulation, to the sixth seal and the seventh seal, which is the day of the Lord. And that's also what we read in Zephaniah of these heavenly signs, and it says that this day of the Lord is coming quickly and the things that come with it. So it's important to notice the order of these events then. There are three separate events. The first comes the tribulation as described in the first five seals. Then the heavenly signs come through the sixth seal. And then at the end of the sixth seal it says, for that great day of wrath has come, that it introduces that seventh seal, which is the day of the Lord. that as we get through the end of the sixth seal and the seventh seal, that that's when the day of the Lord seems to begin. That it indicates that that's when God's punishment, the wrath of the Lamb, is poured out. And we're told that the heavenly signs occur after the time of the tribulation has begun, but before the day of the Lord has taken place. The prophet Joel also acknowledges that as well. So once again, we're told that the heavenly signs take place after the tribulation has begun, but before the day of the Lord takes place. And the book of Joel 2 and verse 30 explains that as well. Joel 2 and verse 30. In Joel 2 and verse 30, a lot of Joel is prophecy of the day of the Lord and these end-time events. And so if we remember, once again, the first five seals kind of represent the tribulation. In the sixth seal, those heavenly signs take place, and at the end of the sixth seal it says, the day of the Lord is coming quickly or is at hand. And we see this as well, but the heavenly signs are really the introduction to that day of the Lord. Because we see in Revelation, or Joel 2 and verse 30, and I will show wonders in the heavens and in the earth, blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun shall be turned into darkness and the moon into blood before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord. So it says, before the coming of the great and awesome day of the Lord, there's going to be these heavenly signs. That blood and fire and pillars of smoke, the sun will be turned into darkness and the moon into blood. And it says these things will take place before that day of the Lord happens. So again, just reaffirming that same thing we read in Matthew 24 and in Revelation 6, that these heavenly signs are the introduction to the day of the Lord. That that's what leads in from the tribulation to the day of the Lord as well. And so why is this significant? It's important for us to then realize that there are two separate things that will be taking place here as we get to the end time. That the end time persecution and martyrdom of these saints, which will probably also be directed at physical Israel, begins before these heavenly signs take place, that it began in the fifth seal. And that it's really a product and expression of human nature and Satan's leadership on mankind. Now if we turn to Revelation chapter 12 for just a minute, we'll see kind of an interlude here as we talk about this. Because we'll see that Satan's wrath began kind of with these seals. And since he's been, you know, denied the authority that he wants over all of mankind. That God has given him an extent of authority, but never what he really wanted. So here in Revelation 12 and verse 12, we see that a lot of these things that take place before the day of the Lord is actually Satan's wrath as well. Revelation 12 and verse 12. It says, therefore, rejoice, O heavens, and you who dwell in them. Woe to the inhabitants of the earth and to the sea. For the devil has come down to you having great wrath because he knows that he has a short time. So here at the end, as we get close to the end time, it says Satan comes down to the earth with great wrath because he knows his time is coming short. Seems to be symbolic and indicate when these tribulations maybe really intensify and begin. Because in verse 13 then we're told, now when the dragon saw that he had been cast to the earth, he persecuted the woman who gave birth to the male child. And all through Revelation, the woman who gave birth to the male child is the church. So the church is being persecuted by Satan. Again, symbolic of tribulation and martyrdom that will take place from Satan on the church. It says, but the woman who was given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness to her place, where she's nourished for a time and times and half a time. And we believe that indicates a 3.5 year period, because time being 1 year, times being 2 years, and a half a time being a half a year. So it says that Satan comes down angry because he's cast to the earth, and that God gives protection to his church, or at least a portion of his church, for 3.5 years. Because Satan is angry and coming at them, trying to murder his church. But we're also told, if we drop down to verse 17 for just a minute, it says, and the dragon was enraged with a woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ. Which is an indication that when God protects a group of his people, that Satan then turns his attention to others who maybe, for whatever reason, God is allowing to stay and have to suffer through the wrath of Satan as well. The Satan attacks the rest of the church that God isn't protecting as these things take place. What's interesting is that we're told that this happens for 3.5 years, a time times and a half a time. And that 3.5 year period comes up over and over in the Bible, actually. But as we think about Satan's wrath takes place for those 3.5 years that the church is protected, we also see this in a few other places as well. If we go over back to Revelation chapter 11 for just a moment. Revelation 11 and verse 2. Because here we're told something about Jerusalem, and it ties into this 3.5 years as well. In Revelation 11 and verse 2, it says, "But leave out the court which is outside the temple, and do not measure it, for it has been given to the Gentiles. And they will tread the holy city underfoot for 42 months." So first we're told 3.5 years of protection, or times and half a time. Then we're told for 42 months that Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles. And then if we continue down in verse 3, we're also told, "And I will give power to my two witnesses, and they will prophesy 1,260 days, clothed in sackcloth." And 1,260 days also rounds out to about 3.5 years. So we're told that Satan's going to come down angry and attack the church, and it'll be protected for 3.5 years. We're told Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles, or, you know, people who want to destroy the city for 3.5 years. And then we're told that these two witnesses will be prophesying and witnessing for 3.5 years as well. So all these things indicate that there's going to be a 3.5 year time period that's going to take place at the end. And all these are connected within that 3.5 year time period. But it's interesting that 3.5 years seems to indicate the beginning when Satan is brought down to the earth, when he realizes his time is short, and his wrath is pointed at mankind, and especially the church of God. Now that seems to be maybe when that 3.5 year timeline begins to take place. And that when that begins, that's when the witnesses will come on the scene, and that's also when Jerusalem will be taken over possibly as well. But then what's interesting is that we have this 3.5 year period of Satan's wrath. There's also this 1 year punishment, or what we call the Day of the Lord. No, the Day of the Lord is nowhere specified in Revelation as being an exact amount of time. But it seems to sometimes be implied that it is a year based on some scriptures that we'll look at today. That, once again, if we would turn to Numbers 14:34, we'll just reference that today. But if we remember the story of ancient Israel, they sent the spies into the Promised Land. Remember, they were in the Promised Land for 40 days spying out the land. When they came back because of what they said to the people and the punishment that came, remember how many years they had to walk in the wilderness was 40 years. One day was symbolic of 1 year of punishment. So they spent 40 days scouting it out. So they spent 40 years wondering. So this 1 year was symbolic of 1 day. Then Ezekiel 4 and verses 4 through 6, Ezekiel is commanded that he had to lay on his side for a certain number of days, representing numbers of years. And then he had to roll to his other side, and again, a number of days representing a number of years. So again, we see that the Bible often connects days symbolic of years. And so the Day of the Lord may be symbolic of a year of punishment because of what mankind has done and their disobedience to God. I think Isaiah 34 also is a strong indication of that, if we do want to turn to that one. Isaiah 34 and verse 8. And again, if the Day of the Lord's not 1 year, that doesn't change, you know, what we understand and believe about the end time events. But again, I think it's important sometimes just to look at what the scriptures do say and consider these things when we realize that we're not saying this dogmatically or without a doubt. But instead we're saying this is what it seems to indicate. Isaiah 34 and verse 8 states, "For it is the day of the Lord's vengeance, the year of recompense for the cause of Zion." So it says it is the day of the Lord's vengeance. Remember, the day of the Lord is often connected to the day of wrath, or the day of God's wrath, because of mankind's sins. And here we read about the day of the Lord's vengeance, and it says the year of recompense for the cause of Zion. So here it connects some amount of God's vengeance to a year of recompense, a year of paying for the sins that they've done. So again, I'm not saying dogmatically that the year of the Lord is, or the day of the Lord is a year long, but these scriptures seem to indicate that I think that's a strong possibility. But as we think about it, Satan's wrath is that 3.5 year tribulation, what we've talked about before, that 3.5 years of Satan attacking the church and it being protected, of the two witnesses for 3.5 years, of Jerusalem being trampled underfoot by the Gentiles for 42 months or 3.5 years. But nowhere does the Bible ever say that Satan's wrath ends and then the day of the Lord takes place. That if we think about what we read in prophecy, that Satan's wrath doesn't stop until when? You know, until he's bound and locked away, up until the very end of his authority and his freedom, he's attacking the saints and he's doing as much damage as he can. So that 3.5 years of his wrath probably go all the way to that time when he's bound, symbolic of what we're talking about on the Day of Atonement. And so then that lends to indicate that this day of the Lord is probably the final year of that 3.5 year tribulation. That Satan has a 3.5 years of wrath on the earth. And that last year is also overlapped by the day of the Lord. That 1 year of wrath of mankind's, you know, justified vengeance on the earth as well for the sins of mankind. So again, this isn't a dogmatic, I'm saying that this is the way it has to be or the only way that it can be interpreted. But this is what the church believes, and it's all the scriptures I've read and indicated, I think, feel the same way, that there's no indication that Satan's going to stop his wrath and allow God just to have a year of his own wrath. But instead, until Satan's locked away, his wrath is continuing on the earth until up to the very end. But for some period of time, what I believe to be that last year, the God's pouring out his wrath through those trumpets and the last bowls as well on the rest of mankind. As we consider this, then, if we go back to Revelation 6 one more time, we'll see that as we go back to the end of Revelation 6, we'll read in verses 12 through 17, once again, that sixth seal. Because really, this really is the transition piece from the tribulation to the trumpets. And it states, "I looked when he opened the sixth seal, and behold, there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth of hair, and the moon became like blood, and the stars of heaven fell to the earth as a fig tree drops its late figs when it is shaken by a mighty wind. Then the sky receded as a scroll when it was rolled up, and every mountain and island was moved out of its place. And the kings of the earth, the great men and the rich men, the commanders, the mighty men, every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and the rocks of the mountains, and said to the mountains and rocks, 'Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne, and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of his wrath has come, who was able to stand?'" So again, we see these heavenly signs, and it seems to be an indication that the day of the Lord is coming. So they hide themselves in the caves and say, you know, fall on us, they'd rather be dead at this point than to suffer the consequences of what's about to come. Because it says, "For the great day of his wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" And we think then that that would lead right into the seventh trumpet, the seventh seal then, and the seven trumpets. But instead, Revelation gives us this interlude for a whole chapter. And in this chapter, we're told about this 144,000. And it's interesting as we consider this in Revelation 7 and verse 3, that there's 177,000, or 144,000, I'm sorry, who are protected. In verse 3 it says, "Do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. And I heard the number of those who were sealed, 144,000 of all the tribes of the children of Israel were sealed." So it seems to indicate, as this tribulation is going from this first 2.5 years when the day of the Lord's about to begin, that God takes a moment and pauses, and he seals 144,000 of Israelites. He says 12 from these different tribes. And he says he places a seal on their head, and that they couldn't harm the earth or the sea until the seal had taken place, symbolic of them being set aside or maybe protected. But then verse 9, we also see another group as well. In verse 9 it says, "After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude which no one could number, of all nations, tribes, peoples, and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed with white robes, with palm branches in their hands, and crying out with a loud voice, saying, 'Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb.' So this another group of people, separate from the 144,000, it says this group is from all the different nations, so different nationalities of Gentiles, of any nationality group of people. And over in verse 13, it says, "Then one of the elders answered and saying to me, who are those arrayed in white robes and where did they come from?" So here John's asked by one of the elders, you know, who is this big group of people? And John says, you know, sir, you know, probably because he had no idea, so it's good to ask a question back. And he says, so he answered me, "These are the ones who came out of the great tribulation and washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will dwell among them." So then we're told that this is a group of people, it says, who came out of the great tribulation, who had their robes washed and made them white through the blood of the Lamb. So it's symbolic that there's a group of people as well, independent of that 144,000, who come out of the great tribulation converted to God's way. You know, it's something that we don't often dwell on with all these events taking place, these seals and these wars and the famines and pestilence. But throughout all this, there seems to be these large groups of people who are somehow converted to God's way. The first is 144,000 who are sealed before the seventh seal is opened. And there's also this great multitude here as well. And there's a lot of debate about whether this multitude is alive or dead at this point, as it says, you know, they're before the throne of God. And that, if we continue in verse 16, it says, "They shall never hunger anymore nor thirst anymore." That seems to indicate that they're probably spirit beings at this point. But again, this could be symbolically picturing the future. Though we don't know all the details, once again, of Revelation, but it's interesting to consider that there's this huge group of people converted during the tribulation. That maybe all the preaching that goes on, that takes place, and those maybe who we have talked to, who knows the truth, who maybe walked away at one point or another, maybe these things are a good wake-up call to them and bring them back to a place where they have a relationship with God. And that God says there's this innumerable multitude that's at this time that comes out of the tribulation. And to me, it's a sign of hope and strength that during all these things, all these terrible things that we can read about going on and the death and the suffering that's going to take place, there's also this massive conversion that will take place as well. We have to remember that there's the two witnesses on the earth at this time doing amazing wonders, as well as breathing fire from their mouth and other things that will be quite a witness as well to the truth of the Bible and God's plan. But it says these people will be converted, and they remind everyone, it says salvation belongs to our God, is what this group says. And so they come to the point of where they realize the salvation and the truth that God's message has. And so again, that this is a weird kind of strange place to have this interlude from the tribulation taking place right before the day of the Lord when God's wrath is poured out. We're going to have a whole chapter devoted to this group that's being converted and called out. And so we see that again, the 144,000 of it seems to be physical descendants of Israel who are sealed. And then this great multitude beyond being counted of other people from all types of nations and walks of life. We're going to be converted as well, who come out of the tribulation, washed and given salvation as well. So it's an amazing time that we read here. But then we go straight then into the seventh seal in chapter 8 of Revelation. Now I won't spend a lot of time in this today because, you know, the Feast of Trumpets is only, what, a week and a half away, and these things will be connected to that. That today I want to spend most of my time kind of leading up to those things to remind us of what's taking place as the real trumpets are sounded out and those things happen and Jesus Christ returns, that this is the state of the world at that time. And it's a sad state with a lot of destruction and death, but also a time of hope for a lot of people who came to the truth of God and who were converted during that time as well. And so it's interesting as we view this then, and even as we think about the Feast of Trumpets, that it is the fourth holy day within the seven-day plan, that the Feast of Trumpets really kind of concludes the first half and really begins a whole second set of holy days as well, that as much as all seven are connected, there's also definitely a distinction between the spring feast and the fall feast. But the spring feasts are in a lot of ways about the first fruits now of being the Passover was to sanctify the first fruits or the firstborns of Israel. And that then the fall feasts connect to the rest of mankind and show the same lessons, the same symbolisms, but kind of through a different scale and a different way as well. So as we come to this Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of Trumpets, it's kind of wrapping up one plan of salvation for a group and beginning kind of a new plan of salvation for a group in one sense. Again, we can't separate them and they all are connected, but at the same time, it is interesting to consider that the fourth or the middle holy day kind of concludes one section with the return of Jesus Christ and the establishment of the kingdom of God on the earth and the resurrection of the saints, and it leads right into God then working on the next big harvest as well through the binding of Satan, through the millennium setting on the earth, all the way through the second resurrection and the chance of everyone to know God and have their chance of salvation as well. So then as we come to these fall holy days, I hope I've been able to give you a reminder of what society is going to be like at that time, what mankind is going to be suffering through, and what type of life is going to be happening, and what's the scene when Jesus Christ returns, the setting of, if we want to put it that way, the setting of the book of Revelation. The earth has been devastated by Satan and his influence and the consequences of human nature and sin. But there will be two witnesses preaching, converting a mass number of people during that time as well. And then it's going to be a very sobering time, a time of destruction and death and misery, but also a time of hope and a future as well. And with that thought, I want to end in one last verse over in Jeremiah chapter 29. In Jeremiah chapter 29 is one of the most hopeful verses in the Bible, I think. Jeremiah 29 and verse 10. Here we read about the exile of Judah. In verse 10 it says, "For thus says the Lord, after 70 years are completed at Babylon, I will visit you and perform my good word toward you, and cause you to return to this place." So here is Judah's being reminded that they're going to be taken to Babylon, and after 70 years, God's going to show mercy on them and bring them back to live in Jerusalem once again. He says, "For I know the thoughts that I think toward you, says the Lord, thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give you a future and a hope." That how symbolic is that time that they're going through, true of the end time as well. That they'd rebelled against God, and so they were punished, sent into exile to Babylon. Much like mankind has rebelled against God, and they followed the dictates of Satan and sin and all the destruction that comes with it. But that God doesn't leave them there, just like he didn't leave Israel and Judah in captivity, but promises to bring them back and did bring Judah back to Jerusalem. He says he has thoughts of peace and not of evil, to give a future and a hope. And as these days do picture, judgment and destruction at times, ultimately they picture a hope and a future, that God's plan is a plan of peace to all mankind, that there are sometimes punishments for actions and consequences, but ultimately God's thoughts are thoughts of love and of peace and of a future and a hope. So again, as we think about these days, I hope we can be reminded that these days are really all about a hope and a future for all of mankind. So I hope we have a wonderful fall feast, holy day season, and wonderful fall feast days. Let's be sure we focus on their meaning, not only for us, but also for all of mankind.